Thanksgiving, a cloudy morning as the Turkey Day run kicks off in downtown Kenosha, but a sunny afternoon, a high reaching 27. Black Friday, cloudy, 50-50 chance of light snow with a high of 33. Look at this, Saturday, partly sunny and 43. Sunday and Monday, temperatures in the mid-30s. Tuesday, again, 43. Here are the numbers right now under a pretty much overcast sky. Wind is calm. Here are the temperatures, 18 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha, 15 for Burlington, Elkhorn, Lake Geneva, and Milwaukee. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. WGTD News time now coming up on 8:11. The morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Support for the morning show also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andreas, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, glad to be back after a day out sick and feeling fine today, and especially happy to welcome into our studios someone who's joined us before, and let's make sure we get her name correct, Jennifer Sassaman. Jennifer Sassaman, who is assistant professor of theater arts at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And she is joining us today in part one of today's morning show to talk about the latest presentation or production of Parkside's Theater Department, and what an intriguing idea it is. A very familiar title, but with an intriguing twist. It's A Wonderful Life, but done in the format of a radio play. And doing this in this fashion has presented all kinds of interesting challenges to the cast. And so we're going to be talking about that and about what people can expect from It's a Wonderful Life at UW Parkside, which will be opening on Thursday night, the 4th of December, and running that weekend, that first weekend in December. Jennifer Sassaman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's so nice to be here again.
Good to have you here. Remind me, what did we talk about the last time you joined us, which was the first time I think you've joined us on the morning show?
It was the first time. The last time we talked about The Taming of the Shrew.
Oh, right.
And our 1940s Rosie the Riveter production.
Absolutely. And so here we go again with, again, a familiar title, but done in unconventional fashion, that is, It's a Wonderful Life, but presented as a radio drama, as a radio play. First of all, give us some background on It's a Wonderful Life itself, which most of us know as, of course, the classic Frank Capra film. Is that how it began? Was it based on anything that existed before that film was made?
No, it wasn't based on anything before the film was made. And in fact, I was surprised to learn when working on this project, my wonderful dramaturg, Jasmine Medina, unearthed some information that the first time this movie came out, it opened December 25th, 1946, it was kind of a flop. Audiences didn't really respond to it, although Frank Capra continued to say for his whole career that that was his favorite movie. And it wasn't until later decades, when it started being rebroadcast on television, that it became this iconic holiday classic. So it makes me so sad because it's so beautiful.
So at what point did it begin to be transformed into something else, something besides that great film? I mean, for instance, at what point did it first become adapted to the stage, or has it been adapted for just in standard format as a standard play?
As far as I know, there aren't a whole lot of Wonderful Life stage scripts done in a fully realized format. This is the script is by Joe Landry, and it's been out for several years, and it's a
the
very
one you're using.
The one we're using. And it's very simple. It's written for five actors plus one sound effects artist. Now, we've made it a little bit broader than that. We have the five actors who play all of the vocal parts that are from the movie, plus we have two people doing the sound effects, plus we have a stage manager who helps things run efficiently. And then we have, because there are some jingles that are sung throughout the play in the commercial breaks, even though we don't take an intermission, there are intermissions from the show. Air bubbles don't work on radio. So we have these three girls, we call them the cigarette girls, and they walk through the audience in the first part of the show, and they pass out programs, and they sell, you know, little 5-cent candies, and then they sing all the jingles. So it's quite a an expansive family from this tiny little show that was initially brought to us.
So if we would look and read and listen to this script by Joe Landry, how close does it adhere to the script or that we know from the film?
I would say 95% of the dialogue is lifted straight out of the film. The changes come, there are a few places where for expedience's sake, or you know, I'm not sure why the playwright made the choices he made, there are a few scenes that don't happen the way they do in the film. It's not as long as the movie, it's an hour and a half total, and the movie is just over 2 hours. So they don't go to the dance, you know, they Mary and George meet up on the way to the dance, and then walk home together, but they don't have the Charleston scene where the gymnasium floor opens and everybody falls into the pool. So because they don't have that, they have to adjust some dialogue to compensate for what is missing. There's also some adjustment simply because it's a radio play and you need some exposition to explain what you cannot see visually.
Can you give an example of that, a moment like that where the writing has to be in such a fashion that we are put there because we can't see there?
Well, I feel like it happens quite a lot. In the scene where George and Mary are coming home, in the movie they come home from the dance, in this they sort of meet up and walk home together instead of going to the dance, and they're at the old Granville house, and you know, it's all deserted, and Mary thinks the house is so romantic, and George, it talks about the tradition where you're supposed to throw a rock, and if you break a window, you get to make a wish. So he throws a rock and makes a wish. So first of all, he explains you have to do this, and then he throws the rock, and there's the sound effect of the glass breaking. And as he talks about the things that he wants, you know, he wants to travel, and he wants to do all these big things, and what Mary wants is to marry George. This has been something, she's been in love with him for years. So as he talks, you see in the film, if you watch it, Donna Reed gets very determined, like, oh, this thing that you want can't happen. And she bends down and she picks up a rock and throws it. And you just see this in the movie. But in the play, you wouldn't, or if you're listening to the radio at home, in theory, you wouldn't see the actress picking up the rock. So the actor has to say, oh, hey, are you going to throw a rock too? You know, he has to describe what she is doing physically.
Right. And I suppose if someone is good at this, then that feels very organic. Probably someone in the audience at your production won't even realize, even if it's a moment that they know really well, they're probably not even going to be particularly alert to the fact that, oh, these extra words are there to help us understand this.
Well, we certainly are doing our best. It's a different animal, radio scripts. And that's not something I ever really thought about. As a kid, I liked to listen to tapes of the old Lone Ranger radio shows. And I've certainly listened to a bunch of radio drama since this whole production process began. And I think that a lot of what I thought of as a person who analyzes text and teaches text analysis, something that I would think of as really sloppy, just awful exposition, is necessary. So I don't know how this will sound to audiences. I feel like we might need to adjust our ears because we're not used to taking in information that of that sort through our ears, information that we could just as easily see through our eyes. The actors and I worked long and hard on making sure that it seemed authentic and true to life. There are some clumsy statements that we have to work around. You know, George gets thrown into the snow. He gets thrown out of the bar, and he lands in the snow. And Clarence, the angel, says to him, "Here, let me help you up. The snow is quite cold." And it's kind of like, well, snow's always cold, but but as a way to establish where he is and what has happened, and not just always say, "Oh, look, you were thrown into the snow."
Right.
You know. The playwright has had to give us this information in a form we're not used to. So it's been very eye-opening to me. I feel like I have a brand new appreciation for this art form that
right.
I did not understand before.
Well, and it helps you understand the difference between good radio drama or radio theater and bad radio theater, because there's certainly plenty of examples of both out there, including, you know, very clumsy amateurish attempts to bring a radio drama to life.
Yeah.
And it sounds like this is a very well-crafted script, and you've tried to be really careful to give it your best shot. How about your students? First of all, what was their acquaintance with It's a Wonderful Life before this? I think we blithely assume that every human being on the planet knows this movie, but actually a lot of young people don't necessarily know a classic like this at all.
It's true. I would say maybe a quarter of my cast was quite familiar with the piece. And one of the things, you know, we talked about the movie. In other shows, when I have directed other shows, I have always avoided, if there's a film version, I don't want to watch it. If there are other stage versions, I don't want to watch it. I want our production to be our production. I don't want to look at that stuff until my production or the one that I'm working on has ended. But I feel like you can't do that with It's a Wonderful Life, because everybody who's coming into the audience, not everybody, but I'd say the vast majority of the people who are going to come see this are walking in with their own relationship to the movie, and they will hear the movie as they go. I mean, I know when I read the script for the first time, I was hearing Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed and Lionel Barrymore in my head as I read through it. So what we did was we did all of the table work and the analysis as a group, and then we staged it. And when we were about 3 weeks into the rehearsal process, we took a night off of stage work, and we all went into Studio B at Parkside, and we watched the movie as a group. And I had kind of assumed that there would be a lot of bantering while we watched the movie and people making jokes. The room was silent. And this is a text that we had been looking at very intimately for 3 weeks, and they were riveted. I could see everybody in the mirror, because there was a mirror below the screen, and I would periodically look around the room. Nobody was texting on their phone. People were really, and I was as well, genuinely connected to the film. So that's how we got everybody else connected to the movie, the people that hadn't watched it before. And because we feel that people have a relationship with this movie already, there are certain places where we have said, okay, well, they do this in the movie this way. Why don't we incorporate that same interpretation in our version? Not for everything. The actors have definitely built their own parts, and have crafted crafted their own work, but they have incorporated elements from the film when they felt like it worked for them authentically.
I should think casting this was an interesting experience, given the fact that because you have, and do all five play multiple roles?
Yes, everybody plays at least two roles. Mm-hmm. The actor who plays George just plays grown-up George and boy George. And then the actress who plays Mary plays both the adult and the child Mary. And the other three actors play everyone else. Mm. And the challenge with casting this is, and actually this is sort of the challenge, another challenge on working on the show. This, mostly when I work on a play, I try to think about what is the spine of the show, what is at its center, what is this story about. But this play has two separate spines. We have the story of George Bailey and It's a Wonderful Life, but we also have the story of these radio actors and sound technicians. You know, everybody on stage has a character in addition to the people they're playing in the radio play. So this is definitely a play within a play. And there is almost no information given about the radio drama actors, but it's something that you have to craft. So that has been really fun, given just a tiny bit of clues at the very beginning based on the movie. There's an intro at the beginning where the host of the show introduces each of the radio actors and says, oh, these are the things that they're, these are the projects that you know them from, and this is what they're working on. So you kind of get a sense of type. So there's the ingenue, and then there's sort of the siren, and then there's the comic, and then there's the romantic lead. Everybody's got their own niche of these five performers. And the actors working on the show constructed entire lives for these people. And we have story arcs not just for It's a Wonderful Life, but we also have the ones we have created for the radio actors. Mm.
Well, that just shoots out of the sky what the main point of my question was, actually, which was I was going to follow up and say, so this was a case in which you could cast this play and not worry about what people looked like. I mean, whoever played George could be white, black, purple, 6 feet, 3 feet. I mean, it wouldn't matter because, in a sense, all they are in this production are their voice. And that's not right.
No, actually, the premise of the play is that it is December 24th, 1946. We're in New York City, and this is a live radio broadcast. And our incredible costume designer, Doris D'Amata Geiger, came to me very early in the process and said, have you thought about the fact that because this is Christmas Eve, it might be a formal event? And so instead of people just kind of talking into the microphone in their jammies or just a nice outfit, this is a big event. So when people walk into the theater on December 4th, 2014, they're really walking into December 24th, 1946.
Wow.
The play begins the second you walk into the room, even though the action of the spoken text doesn't start until 7:30. So the cigarette girls that are also singing all the backup, they're moving through the audience. They're interacting with the audience.
And in character.
In character, in costume, in character. And you see the sound technicians setting up for the show. You see them testing out all of their many, many little things they use to create the sounds. You see the stage manager setting up the show. You're coming into this world. And, you know, when the on-air sign at the very end of the play turns off, the play actually continues for another few moments so that the storylines that we have created can wrap themselves up.
Mm. What about your actors and what it's like for them to be up on that stage performing as these characters? I mean, I guess it's a double-decker performance. Mm-hmm. They are portraying an actor who is portraying, for instance, George Bailey. But in front of a microphone, so not freely moving about the stage they otherwise would in a standard theatrical production. What kind of a challenge has that specifically posed to your actors?
Well, I think that it can be difficult for an actor to get to where they need to be emotionally in a scene if they are not physically embodying what's happening to them. I think that, you know, one of the classes that I teach at Parkside is movement. I'm a big proponent of the physical component of theater. So if you're supposed to be really mad and or really in love love and you're standing there, it's hard. And actually, one of the storylines that our actors have come up with is the idea that the person who's playing George is a big matinee idol, and you know, somebody who would never be doing theater, you know, radio theater, thinks it's completely beneath him, only is doing this because it's required in his publicity contract for the movie that's about to come out. And and that the woman who's playing Mary is an ingenue and who is about to break it big but has not. She has a movie coming out that's about to change her career, but still she looks at all of this with this, the big blinky doe eyes. And the two of them are very physical performers. And then the other three are sort of your standard radio actors who do this week after week and are very used to generating loud emotions while standing still. But the two film idols, the two film stars, are throwing the scripts away and they are doing really big physical acting, and that it's a surprise to the radio actors. So we have incorporated a bit more physicality than would have normally happened in a radio play. But one of the things that I have come to is this idea that this is a magical night. That this one performance is something really special for everybody involved, and that something is happening in this performance that doesn't usually happen in radio theater. And because of the incredible passionate commitment that the two film actors bring into it, it elevates the caliber of performance for everybody.
Hmm. What prompted you to want to do this? I mean, specifically, It's a Wonderful Life, and then also to do it in this format. What did you think would be the benefit or the most substantial gain in doing it this way?
Well, last year when we as a department were talking about our season, we started talking about some of the plays that we had done at Christmas time in the past that were maybe a little bit against the vein of the season. I'm not sure, you know, if you're doing Night Mother, a play, you know, something really dark, not that that's what we did at Christmas, but if you're doing something really dark and heavy, and at Christmas time people want to be a part of something more stirring. I don't know. Mm. So we talked about just the possibility of, you know, are there any Christmas type holiday shows that we could be doing, something that is a little bit closer to the season. And also, you know, there, like every other university in the country, we are struggling with funding. So we tried to think of ways that we could produce really high quality theater, maybe as a way to save some money. So we thought the radio play might be an easier idea. We threw out a bunch of different titles, different holiday titles, and I had a friend who had done this production elsewhere in the country, so I was familiar with the story. Proposed it, and it seemed like a good idea. And I didn't realize just how much I would come to love this play when I sort of casually said, oh, hey, I know about this show. This is a really nice show my friend did. And that's how it came to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like it's an absolutely fantastic idea. I know that one of the aspects of it that, of course, will be of great interest to the audience, for anybody who's gone to any of our 91.1 Players performances, will also, you'll probably appreciate what's the kind of the fun of the sound effects and all of that. And putting all of that together, I should think, is no small matter. Do you have to create all of that sort of from scratch? Or are there places you can rent little doors for sound effects or whatever it is that you're using? Or are you generating some of these sound effects in other ways? Or is it all analog sound effects, so to speak?
There are two levels of sound usage in this. Aside from just the sound generated by the speaking actors, we have the sound effects that are created by the Foley artists, and everything that you hear, there are no recorded sound effects. Everything down to piano music. I mean, one of the artists hops off the sound booth and comes down and plays the piano when Janie's supposed to be practicing Silent Night. Mm. it's fascinating to me to see what our design team came up with. And the script comes with suggestions, but our sound artist, John Costigan, worked with his team, and they did all kinds of research on here's one way you can make the sound, here's another way you can make the sound. So we don't break glass, you know, when George throws rock, it's a sound effect. Mm. We don't have a train, obviously, coming through the set, but if you have a brush and a wash tub and a train whistle, you can make it sound like there's a train right there. It's really cool. Wow. If you press into a box of cornstarch really close to the mic, it sounds like you're walking on snow. Mm. There are just so many fascinating little tricks that have long been a part of the work of a Foley artist. Now, on top of that, we have a lot of use of music, and that was something that working on this play, also while teaching theater history and hitting the point of theater, Western theater, where melodrama became popular, overlapped so interestingly for me. Because I had never really understood that melodrama, I didn't know the word melodrama itself means music and theater together. Right. Not musical theater, but the use of underscoring, the use of music to create, to generate whatever mood you want from your audience. So listening to old-time radio shows, I was hearing just how completely the scenes were shaped by the music used within them. So again, John Costigan found old Oregon recordings of things, but also recorded stuff himself. He just built this incredible bank of theme music, basically. Mm-hmm. And we went through all the different little transitions, because it's almost like radio drama is a series of short vignettes. You have this scene, and then there's a little musical bookmark, and then there's another little scene, and then music transitions you to another scene. And if it's happy and uplifting, then you want a happy, uplifting transition. And if it's, you know, that dun-dun-dun, you know, if you need the audience to feel suspenseful, you need suspenseful music. And some of it underscores it. So there's so many, there are so many sound cues in this show. And I wouldn't have, this was a whole world I was not familiar with before I went into this process.
You also mentioned before we went on the air that the audience will see your actors in front of vintage-style microphones.
Yes.
Which actually conceal a little secret.
Yes. Well, I said that, and then I realized I wasn't 100% sure. I know that the microphones that the Foley artists have in their sound booth are vintage looking, and that there's a tiny little super high-tech contemporary mic concealed underneath it to really capture the sound as purely as possible. I believe, though, the three mics that the actors use actually are authentic microphones.
Ah, okay.
So I think it's a mixture up there of... Mm.
Well, the last time I saw a radio production, so to speak, at UW Parkside was a few years ago when the music department presented an opera that was written for the radio back in 1939, Giancarlo Menotti's Old Maid and the Thief. And it was absolutely fascinating. It was not only a wonderful production musically, I mean, a really fine performance by a really good cast, but all of these other little details involving vintage commercials here and there and so on were really handled beautifully. And I loved every minute of it. And so... I'm very, very intrigued by this, and hope that I'll get to experience it myself, because it sounds like a really special treat. So remind our listeners about exactly when these radio-style performances of It's a Wonderful Life are going to be happening out at the University of Wisconsin Parkside.
So they're happening on the main stage of the Rita Talent Picken Regional Center for the Performing Arts, and the shows are December 4th. At 7:30, Thursday, December 4th, and then we have two shows on Friday the 5th, one at 10 in the morning and one at 7:30. We have a Saturday show at 7:30, and then we have a Sunday matinee at 2. And both the Friday and Saturday shows, we have our new Rita Bistro, where you can get a nice drink and a little snack before the show starts. And then on Sunday, the closing day is actually, we're having a family day, so that children with adults get in for, I think, $250, like a super inexpensive ticket. Santa Claus is going to be there, so you can take your picture with Santa. There's going to be a hot chocolate bar. So there's all sorts of fun things that are happening around the show.
Very good. What do people do if they want to get tickets?
They can go to our website. They can go to our box office in the Pickin, in the regional, we call it the Rita, in the Rita box office. You can get tickets the night of the show.
All those ways. Okay, sounds good. Well, it sounds like an absolutely delightful way to spend a little time. And as you mentioned, it's as shorter than the movie. So this isn't a long thing to sit through either.
It's an hour and a half. It's an hour and a half with no intermission. So it just kind of, it rolls through very quickly.
And you leave them wanting more.
And there is a big, there's a big surprise at the end. But I'm not going to give it away. You have to come see what it is.
All right. So It's a Wonderful Life, December 4th through December 7th. At the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And Jennifer Sassaman, Assistant Professor of Theater Arts, great to talk with you again, and congratulations on what I'm sure is going to be a very successful and well-received production of It's a Wonderful Life.
Thank you. It's always lovely to talk to you.
It's 20 minutes before 9 o'clock, and this is The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two of today's program. Well, I have certainly experienced the reality of that old saying, you can't judge a book by its cover. Recently, there arrived in the mail a gorgeous sort of coffee table book called Houses of the Founding Fathers, The Men Who Made America and the Way They Lived. And I assumed, on the strength of that title and it's the beautiful cover of this book, that this was pretty much a book just about the homes in which some of our founding fathers lived. And indeed, the book is full of gorgeous photographs and some interesting insights into what these structures were like then and now. But in fact, there is much, much more than that in the pages of this remarkable book, which really helps us understand a bit more about these important men, who they were, how they lived, and the role which they played in these crucial events which led to the founding of our country. And so there is a whole lot more than meets the eye in this beautiful book, which again is called Houses of the Founding Fathers. And the photographs are by Robert Staus III, and the text is by Hugh Howard, who has devoted a great deal of time over the last couple of decades to the topic of historic architecture. His books include Dr. Kimball and Mr. Jefferson, Rediscovering the Founding Fathers of American Architecture. And this newest book is published by Artisan. And Hugh Howard, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Nice to be here, Greg.
I am so happy to talk to you, and I'm so glad that I took a second look at your book and came to realize just how much is here. It's a very, very valuable book, which I think a lot of people are going to really find interesting. Can you help us understand how you came up with the idea?
Well, Roger, my photographer compadre, Roger Strauss, and I had done a previous book called Thomas Jefferson, Architect, which was essentially a monograph on Jefferson's architecture. And the publisher at Artisan approached us and said, gee, guys, you've done an interesting book on one founding father. How about if we do one on all the founding fathers? And basically, we said, if you want to publish it, we'll do it. So we set to work. Not that the finished product is anything like what we anticipated, because, as you say, it is a much more varied and complex kind of book than at first meets the eye.
Absolutely. And what a wonderful idea it is. And this book is about these founding fathers and where they lived. And it's so interesting to be kind of talking about both of those things all at once, and we just don't do that all that often. I don't think we do, anyway. What is it that you think we gain by approaching the founding fathers in this particular way?
Well, I think we're very fortunate that we live in what you might call a multidisciplinary age, where no longer do we simply look at the founding fathers and their political beliefs and how they interacted at the Continental Congress, but we take a much broader based look at the people who inhabit our past. So I think it's interesting and illuminating to see how George related to Martha, and how these various marriages, and how they as parents, how they as slave owners, how they as in a variety of different guises live their lives, and how those lives, those personal lives, those private lives, affect affected the way they shaped our nation.
In a sense, we're looking at them more as human beings this way.
Yes, we absolutely are.
And not just figures in history.
And they lived at a very difficult time. I mean, when we go to some of these houses and we see the charm and the atmosphere and the lovely simple paint colors and the seeming purity of the time, of course, what we forget is that it was a very tough time. Average child only had a 50-50 chance of living to adulthood.
One of the inspirations for the project and sort of a central visual focus is that of the famous painting that many Americans know of the Declaration of Independence being signed, the famous painting by John Trumbull. Tell us a little bit about that painting and indeed the way in which it serves as sort of a spiritual framework for the project which ensues.
Well, John Trumbull was a very interesting character, the son of a Connecticut governor who, kind of against his father's better wishes, became a painter. And he went to Europe to learn how to be a painter, worked in the London studio of Benjamin West, and then traveled at one point to Paris and spent some time with Thomas Jefferson. And in fact, the two of them were sitting around thinking about Mr. Trumbull's notion of doing a series of paintings about great American events in this recent revolution. And between the two of them, of course, Jefferson had been there at the time of the writing of the Declaration and had done much of the writing himself. Between the two of them, they actually sat down, did some sketching, and cooked up the notion of a big painting, which is called the Declaration of Independence, July 4, 1776. And a very large version of that hangs in the Capitol in Washington, D.C. And in some ways, I think what they accomplished in doing that was establishing that moment as one of the really sort of keynote times in the evolution of the American nation. In that painting, which has 40-odd figures in it, in fact, there were 56 who signed the Declaration of Independence, but not quite all of them are in that painting. Nevertheless, it is kind of the point of origin that we use for thinking about this book and these people.
I like how you describe that painting as, in a sense, a sort of a photo op of another generation. Not that that situation was painted live, it was after the fact, certainly, but that every face is visible to us viewing the painting in the way, too, that in most photo ops, when some legislation is being signed into law, those kind of events tend to be, to some extent, carefully choreographed to make everybody visible. And in a sense, this sort of seeks to achieve the same thing, to place really central figures literally in the center of the painting and very prominently, and other people of somewhat lesser significance, but significant nonetheless, at least visible in the background for us.
Yeah, it's a very interesting photograph.
Yeah.
I mean, what am I saying? Photograph. I mean, we think of things in photographic terms in these days, but of course, that was not a technological option then. So it required a painting or some other kind of created artwork to represent that time. And I think that what we think of as photo ops today are in some ways public political opportunities, and so was this painting.
Hmm. And so then in a sense, what you are doing in your book is to trace back some of those figures who are in this painting and to show us who they were and where they lived and what their lives were apart from this important moment in their respective lives.
Yes, that's right. I mean, that was just one moment that I think kind of set the tone for the revolution to follow. But those men arrived at the Continental Congress with a certain amount of intellectual cultural baggage, and things changed radically in the ensuing years. And I think in some ways a better place to see how they lived their lives, how they changed, is to go and look at their domiciles, to look at their houses, to look at the furniture, to look at the designs of their places, to look at their settings. And that's what we set out to do in photos and images.
By the way, I appreciate the clarification you give towards the very beginning of the book, not only with a cast of characters in which we can read in fairly short order the names and brief capsule summaries of each of the people whose lives we explore. But there's also an interesting moment when you clarify the difference between the signers, the framers, and the founding fathers. Tell our listeners about that distinction.
Well, when we started doing this book, the first instinct we had was, all right, let's go look at the houses of the signers, because they are the guys who signed the Declaration of Independence and therefore are the most obvious of the founders. In truth, there weren't quite enough houses surviving, oddly enough, to fill a book with just signers, again, people who signed the Declaration of Independence. So we broadened our search and incorporated framers. Framers is the term we use to describe people who helped frame, and most of whom also then signed the Constitution. And that founding fathers can be more generally defined to include not only signers and framers, but also patriots, military men, judges, jurists, diplomats. There's even a spy in this book, Silas Deane of Connecticut. So there were a mix of folks who played significant roles in shaping the early days of our nation, not all of whom signed the keynote document.
Let's talk for a moment about what you just touched on, the fact that not every home survives that we would wish to be able to visit now and see. And actually, there's sort of an array of reasons why they are not available, that some don't even exist anymore, and that there are even a couple that exist but cannot be visited. Explain this to us.
Well, I think the majority of missing buildings, if you will, are a consequence of just plain old-fashioned disinterest in the early days of the Republic. That is to say, you know, after the country was established, people weren't immediately thinking about how formative and how significant the Revolutionary Era was, and they were going about their lives of building the country and establishing commerce, and the frontier was moving west, and so a lot of these houses burned, in some cases were demolished. Some of these places were downtown in big cities, where today there are great big skyscrapers. So they became kind of irrelevant, and it was really only in the middle of the 19th century, with the conservation of George Washington's Mount Vernon, that people began to think about these antique places as important in the historic context.
Tell us about the one or two homes that still exist but are not available to the public.
Well, there are a few houses that were owned by signers or framers that, in at least one case, remain in the original family. And there are some others that that are private homes. Most of them, you know, one way or the other, by begging or inquiring, one can see. But for purposes of our book, what we were trying to do was find sites that had not only the original building, but in it, possible original objects, original things in the house that the founding fathers and their families would actually have touched and have known. So that if George Washington came back to life today and he walked into Mount Vernon, he would recognize the place. And we were looking to find places where that was true, again, to give a stronger sense of what the lifestyle of the time was like. So houses that are in the hands of other people and have modern furnishings in them were not as interesting to us from the standpoint of understanding history, not to mention taking nice pictures.
I can think of at least one example in the book in which we walk into a living room, and on the wall is beautiful yellow wallpaper, and that wallpaper is a copy of what the original wallpaper was 200 plus years ago. And because a little bit of that original wallpaper survives, it could be recreated and put up on the walls. I mean, what an extraordinary thing.
Yes, well, it's wonderful. All of these houses in the book are open to the public. They're all historic sites. And one of the things that has happened in recent generations is a coterie of professionals, of preservation of professionals, has evolved that take care of these houses. And quite frankly, this book couldn't exist if I hadn't had the wonderful cooperation of, you know, hundreds of these people who showed me their places and told me about them. And equally, these places wouldn't exist if it weren't for the caretakers who go to the trouble of finding a little tiny scrap of wallpaper and reproducing it, of finding items in inventories, of seeking back in old records and finding auctions, and collecting the objects and the fabrics and the details that make the places feel so real.
We're speaking with Hugh Howard about his book, Houses of the Founding Fathers, The Men Who Made America and the Way They Lived. There is an extraordinarily helpful little chart on page 7 of the book called How Different Was Life in the 18th Century? And it is not often that history books, at least the history books we read in school, shed light on these kind of seemingly mundane, in fact, fascinating details of everyday life. Share a few of them with our listeners, if you would.
Well, one of them I mentioned before, which is that only about half of children are likely to live to the age of adulthood. Others include slavery, for example, was legal in all 13 colonies. Cooking, all of it was done in and around the fireplace. There was no such thing as a stove at that point. Men and women simply weren't equal. Women couldn't vote, they couldn't hold public office, and unless widowed, they couldn't even own property in most colonies. There was no anesthesia for a childhood, for surgery or childbirth. There are lots of interesting facts that I think separate that time and the way of life from the way we live today.
A couple of my favorites, aside from a minority of city dwellers, everybody was a farmer. And so, I mean, not only is that sort of interesting on the surface, but then we think about people who were shuffling the duties and responsibilities of being a farmer with being a patriot.
Yes, well, life was a lot of work. And from the standpoint of just providing yourself with food, everything was pretty local. We talk about sustainability these days. Well, those guys knew how to do it. Think about transportation, the same thing is true. If you didn't have a horse, you weren't going anywhere because the railroad hadn't been invented yet, not to mention the automobile.
Right. And matters like illumination, that at night the only light came from candles or from moonlight, and the fact that there's no indoor plumbing, the flush toilet, the bathroom, and the kitchen faucet would be 19th century innovations, meaning that chamber pots, outhouses, and buckets were a way of life.
Does
I mean, when
you
we think
live in the 18th century?
Huh?
Does it make you want to live in the 18th century?
Not particularly. I mean, and it's and we don't often think about figures like Alexander Hamilton and outhouses in the same breath. But this was their life. Hugh Howard and his really fascinating and beautiful book about the Founding Fathers is called Houses of the Founding Fathers, the book published by Artisan Press. There'll be no morning show tomorrow or Friday, of course, because of the Thanksgiving holiday, but we look forward to bringing you a series of new morning shows next week, programs which will include a visit from UW Parkside's Dr. James Kinchin, Director of Choral Activities there, talking about their performances of Handel's Messiah, soon to be performed. Next week we'll also include a visit from Carthage's Art Seer, paying his monthly visit to the program. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Support for WGTD's morning show also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Coming up on Monday's program, we will be celebrating the 40th anniversary of Ye Old English Christmas Feast, the spectacular madrigal dinner and madrigal feast which occurs here in Kenosha, now a collaborative venture between the three major high schools here in town, Tremper, Bradford, and Indian Trails. We'll be talking to a couple of different directors, faculty directors, and to three of the students who are involved in this special 40th anniversary edition of Ye Old English Christmas Feast. That's on Monday's morning show, beginning just after 8 o'clock. Our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois is for cloudy and brisk conditions today. Our high temperature will be 33 degrees. Cloudy overnight and cold, dropping down to 22 degrees for an overnight low. Tomorrow, Thanksgiving Day, is going to feature a cloudy morning, a sunny afternoon. Tomorrow's high, 27 degrees. On Friday, a 50% chance of light snow, 33 for the high. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.